Good afternoon. It's 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Monday, the last day of September. I'm Brian Shields. Support for Medical Monday comes from Nathan Littauer Hospital, welcoming pediatrician Ashley Rosloff, MD, to their Decker Drive Pediatric Office in Johnstown. Seeing new patients Monday through Friday, 8:30 to 5, nlh.org. Joining us today is Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians. He's here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He has an extensive background in these areas and is board certified in both. The number to call, 800-348-2551. It's 800-348-2551. All things kidneys today. Dr. Vincent Carcillo, your calls all coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Thank you for joining us today on Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in show. I'm Brian Shields. It's Medical Monday today, and our guest is Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians. He's here to discuss internal medicine and nephrology. He's board certified in both areas. Dr. Carcillo has been with the CDRP since 2004, is the current president and managing partner of the practice, a graduate of the University of Scranton. He completed medical school at the Philadelphia College of Osteopathic Medicine. He trained in nephrology at the Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia. His clinical focus is on home dialysis. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can tweet your questions at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number today, 800-348-2551. Dr. Carcillo, welcome back.
Brian, thanks again for having me. It's so nice to be here again.
What's the difference between the kidney and the liver? I guess there's similarities, but they have different jobs.
Well, there are some similarities, both focused in the abdomen, as you may know. But they're functionally different. Both in some ways will clean the blood, but have different jobs. Liver, you can associate with breaking things down in your blood. For instance, medications many times are broken down in the liver. And kidney is kind of filtering body toxins, things that you normally and naturally produce on a daily basis.
So alcohol goes through the liver, not the kidney. Is that it?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. 800-348-2551. How do we keep our kidneys healthy? What makes them go bad? We know how to take care of our heart. You know, don't smoke, exercise, watch out the red meat, all those kind of things. But are there things we can do to keep our kidneys healthy?
Well, that's a great question. And honestly, I don't get to answer that question very often.
It's too late.
Because by the time patients are coming to see me, they already have usually significant kidney disease. But I would tell you that number one and number two most common reason, and many times they go hand in hand for kidney disease, diabetes and hypertension or high blood pressure.
Okay.
So, and those things are really at epidemic proportions in the U.S. right now. So we're seeing a lot of kidney disease.
800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Jim and Matamoros, go ahead.
Hey, was Appleton and Evans at Scranton when you were there?
I don't remember those names, but this was back in the early 90s.
Quite a bit later. What's the most common bacteria associated with nephritis?
So there's one very commonly accepted bacteria that is associated with nephritis, and I think it's probably reasonable to say what is nephritis. Nephritis, or any kind of itis generally, is an inflammation. And so nephritis is an inflammation that's ongoing in the kidney. And you may know that, Jim, already. But there's a bacteria called group A streptococcus. It's the same kind of bacteria that sometimes causes bad sore throats. And this type of bacteria, although it causes a sore throat, and usually the nephritis is delayed by about 10 days, that can also come from skin infections with the same bacteria.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for calling. It's 800-348-2551 on Medical Monday Vox Pop today. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians is here. The number to call, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. tweet your questions, WAMC Vox Pop, or email us at voxpop@wamc.org. And Robert, go right ahead.
Yes, hello. I recently received an email from a friend of a friend asking for told me to donate a kidney. And so I got a couple of questions. One is, how dangerous is it for the donor to donate a kidney? And second, I have drunk some alcohol in my life, and I'm wondering if that's going to potentially cause a problem and preclude me. So those are my questions.
Okay. Well, Rob, thanks for the call. I do appreciate it. And the question is one that many people who know someone with kidney failure, know someone who's on dialysis, often wonder, especially when that question comes up, could you potentially be a donor for me? And it's a very noble thing. All donors go through a process whereby they are seen by physicians, including the transplant physicians, a nephrologist, and their primary care doctors to make sure that they are safe for surgery and also that their kidney function is good enough that they would be able to give up a kidney and also be fine for the rest of their life. And I'll tell you, by the time patients are through that process, and I would call a kidney donor a patient, they generally do very, very well with the procedure, and they do very well for the rest of their life with just one kidney. Now,
okay,
as far
you.
As the drugs and alcohol, it's very possible those things, as you may or may not know, can cause damage to some of the organs in your body. We had mentioned liver and kidney before. Both of those organs are vulnerable to damage from both drugs and alcohol. So it's one of those things that you would definitely want to get checked out before you consider donation.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. It's 800-348-2551. So we have two kidneys. We can get rid of one and still be okay. Is that it?
Absolutely. There is a certain amount of redundancy that's built into the two organs. And each organ has about a million tiny little filters housed within them. And so over time, especially after the age of 30, you lose a few here and there over time. So small fractions of your kidney function are lost over time. So you wouldn't have the same kidney function, let's say, at 80 years old as you would
right.
in your 20s and 30s.
800-348-2551, the number to call. 800-348-2551. Joanna in South Hadley. Joanna.
I guess I was reading the mind of a prior caller. I'm in my late 60s, and the thought has occurred to me that maybe I could be a kidney donor. I only heard the tail end of your conversation with the fellow. My question was, is there an age limit beyond which people aren't considered for possible donorship?
Another great question, Joanna. Thanks. And, you know, age limits are one of the things that come up both for kidney recipients and kidney donors. And most of the time, it comes down to the health of the individual and how well the transplant physicians think that organ would function in the recipient over time. And so, again, the older you are, the more issues that you may have in terms of medical problems, especially things like diabetes and high blood pressure that we mentioned, would start to exclude you. And so it's more of a medical issue than an age issue.
All right. Thank you so much.
Of course.
Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551. Doctor, you are specializing now in home dialysis. People can receive dialysis at home. It used to be they'd go to the hospital, to the clinic, get all hooked up to the equipment, have to lie there or sit there for hours. Now you can do it at home.
Yes, and we will hear more and more about home dialysis in the coming months to years. You may remember a few months ago, the president signed an executive order which promotes both kidney transplantation and home dialysis. Home dialysis has been around for a very long time. Even in the 60s and 70s, peritoneal dialysis, which is dialysis done through the belly, was available. In the 80s and 90s, dialysis units started to pop up all around the country, and it became much more viable to do dialysis in a center, and so it became wildly popular. home dialysis lost a focus for quite a long time. And to be honest, the number of patients and the percentage of patients who do dialysis at home hasn't changed in decades. That being said, it's really only about 8 to 10% of all the dialysis patients out there. Now, I would tell you that is that's very challenging when you think about how many benefits there are to being at home. If you can imagine the differences, one being sitting in a center with many patients all around you, a lot of bells and whistles, a lot of patient care going on, and a lot less privacy than if you were at your house, maybe sitting in your comfortable chair watching TV while you do your treatment. And that's just one of the benefits.
Is it essentially the same kind of dialysis equipment that you'd have at home that you get at the hospital? Is it smaller, more compact, same idea?
This is also another benefit. And what's interesting is when you pull nephrologists and you say, well, what would you do if it was yourself? If you needed to do dialysis, would you do dialysis in the center or would you do dialysis at home? An overwhelming majority would choose to do dialysis at home. And now the equipment for home hemodialysis is different than what we use in the center, and it's a little bit more portable. The machines are getting more portable as we go, like everything else. Peritoneal dialysis, in fact, doesn't even require a machine. In fact, it could be done without electricity.
800-348-2551. It's Medical Monday. We're talking renal medicine today. It's all about the kidneys, nephrology, with Dr. Vincent Carcillo. More calls in a moment. Medical Monday, Vox Pop. Dr. Vincent Carcillo of Capital District Renal Physicians is the guest today. The number 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Emily is in the Berkshires, Great Barrington. Go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, I have a question about high-protein diets that a lot of people seem to be into these days and the effect on the kidneys in terms of stone production. I myself had a kidney stone that was oxalate-based, and I've been told to be on a low-protein diet. So it's a little confusing. I'm also an athlete, so I'd just like to hear your thoughts about that.
Sure, Emily. Thanks, and great question. You probably feel like you're torn. People giving you advice that's really pulling you in two different directions, especially being an athlete, and people are probably telling you to load up on protein so you can build muscle. Some people may be saying, oh, high-protein diet can help you lose weight. Others may be saying, high-protein diet is bad for the kidneys. So I think to kind of tackle those things, as many as I can with you in the time that we have, you know, having a diet that is rich in protein while you're building muscle is helpful. Now, high-protein diets as a means for weight loss, there are a lot of diets out there, some that are heavy in carbohydrates, some that are heavy in protein. At the end of the day, most of them boil down to a decreased caloric intake. And so we kind of get caught up in the fads and trends and the names, and it's South Beach or it's Atkins or, you know, different names for diets, and we kind of jump in with both feet. But for the most part, they really do all boil down to a decreased caloric intake. And so if you're an athlete, you have good kidney function, whether you're taking more or less protein, and it sounds like if you have a history of kidney stones, it's really animal proteins that have been associated with higher rates for kidney stones. So that's one type of protein that you might want to avoid.
Okay. Thank you.
Of course.
Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551. Kidney stones. I've never had one, thankfully. I know people who have had them, and I guess it's a pain that cannot be described, right?
Absolutely. God bless you that you have not, because, yes, it's an excruciating pain, both for a man or a woman.
Is that the sign of a kidney going bad or kidney stones?
So generally, if the kidney stone is very small and it's not doing any active damage, you might not feel it at all. Mm-hmm. It's when that stone starts to make its way down the tube between the kidney and the bladder that it starts to bounce back and forth and nick the sides of the walls, and that's when you really start to feel that pain. And worst case scenario, it blocks that tube altogether.
Is it just calcium?
Sometimes they're calcium. Sometimes they can be made up of other substances too, but calcium's the most common type of stone.
So they're not perfectly circle They're jagged, and that's what causes
the pain. They're more like a crystal.
800-348-2551. I hope my luck holds out in that department. 800-348-2551. This is Vox Pop. It's Medical Monday. Let's talk to David in Kingston. David.
Hi there, doctor. My 85-year-old father appears to not drink nearly enough fluid as he needs to, and I'm wondering what I can tell him to convince him that he needs to drink and drink and drink more, and what effects that might be having on his kidneys. You know, he's obviously got some prostate issues and might not like getting up, going to the bathroom so much. Maybe that's what's, you know, keeping him dehydrated. But besides that, is there anything I can tell him about how the kidney works and what will fail if he doesn't drink enough fluids?
Hi. So, yeah, you can. I mean, you can certainly have the conversation with him as we talk about kind of in general that good hydration is good for healthy kidneys. Now, it's especially concerning in elderly patients who sometimes have aches and pains and might be taking over-the-counter medications like ibuprofen, Motrins, Advils, those class of medications that we call non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines. When you're taking those medications and you get behind in your fluids, that's when you can really start to have some problems with the kidney function.
Anything specific?
So hydrate up now in terms of what fluids to use to hydrate?
No, what's going to go bad with the kidney? I want to scare him into getting some water.
Well, if you really... No, I don't recommend scaring him, but, you know, if the worst case scenario is that, we do have some patients that come in that are so dehydrated that they're on the borderline for needing dialysis.
Wow. So the kidney doesn't get enough fluids, does it actually not function right?
Yes, the kidney can be finicky, and in certain situations, especially in patients that for some reason are not getting enough oxygen or not getting enough pressure, maybe their blood pressure is very low from a blood pressure medication, maybe that's in combination with one of those over-the-counter medications that we talked about, the kidneys can shut down. And in those situations, sometimes the patients do need dialysis.
So when he gets his urinalysis done, or is it, what would be the test to test kidney function to see if my fears of his dehydration are really merited?
Two easy tests that primary care doctors and sometimes screening stations, like we do set up sometimes with the National Kidney Foundation, do is one is a simple urine analysis. It's a easy test to do because it's very easy to get urine. And there's another blood test that also checks the kidney's ability to clean the blood.
Okay. I'll look into that. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, David. 800-348-2551. We've often heard that 8 glasses of water a day. Is that pretty much the standard to try to meet?
It is the standard that gets talked about. In many instances, though, the patients that I see have restrictions on the amount of fluid that they can take in. They might also have diseases of the heart, diseases of the liver, and have tendency to get swelling, tendency to get short of breath. So 8 glasses is not the recommendation for every person out there. But in general, if you're a healthy person and don't have those types of issues, then it's not a bad idea.
What about the color of the urine? Does that tell you anything?
It sure does, and most people have had this experience. When you wake up in the morning, that first morning urine, a lot of times it's darker, right? And then as you start to move around, you start to get, a few glasses of juice or water and that kind of thing in you. You start to notice the color of the urine becomes more pale. And if you're really drinking a lot of water throughout the day, you might say, oh my gosh, looks like I'm out peeing out water. In fact, you are. Mm-hmm. And so the kidneys are very good at regulating how much water you have in your body. Overnight, there's a mechanism in place in the kidney to concentrate the urine while you're sleeping. If you didn't, you'd be waking up every couple of hours to urinate. And so if you can sleep through the night, 8 to 10 hours, your kidney's concentrating that urine, and that's why you get that dark color.
We have an email from Kevin in Greenfield. I was in the process of getting approved to donate a kidney to a man who my wife had as a student in elementary school. I was refused because I had a history of high blood pressure. Why would that preclude me? Well, you mentioned earlier hypertension.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So people who have high blood pressure, or what we call hypertension, have a stronger incidence of developing kidney problems down the road. And so in many ways, that being one of them, we want to protect the donors, mm-hmm. and donors can do great and live a very good life with one kidney. But again, we want to make sure that the donor is safe so that we're not answering the same question down the road for someone else to donate a kidney to them.
Kathleen in the Berkshires, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. What causes a type 1 diabetic to have protein in their urine?
Well, Kathleen, that's a great question. And so diabetes in general affects the tiny little blood vessels in your body. And so you can imagine those blood vessels are not just in one place. That's why it can get vision problems, because those tiny little blood vessels are in the back of your eye. And those tiny little blood vessels are in the heart. And those tiny little blood vessels are surrounding tiny little filters in the kidney. And if you can imagine that filter like a strainer, sometimes in the office I'll talk about it like a pasta strainer, you know. Mm-hmm. You dump out the pasta and the salt and water goes through, the pasta stays behind. If you start to break that strainer down, though, you'll start to see some pasta in the sink. And that's essentially what's happening. Those filters are breaking down, and now things that normally would have stayed inside your body are getting through the kidney's filter and into the urine.
And how would you recommend the best treatment for that?
So
water.
Yes, you want to stay hydrated, but with diabetes, whether it's type 1 or type 2, you want to have good control of that diabetes, because the better your control is, the less likely that those little blood vessels are getting damaged more and more over time. And so if they are, even if they do have some already, you can really slow the process down with good control of both diabetes and high blood pressure.
So controlling sugar and having good numbers every day could eliminate the protein in the urine, or would you always have to go on medication?
Once you have it, it usually stays with you. Sometimes you can decrease it with medications, but it usually does stay with you to some degree. Now, that being said, with good control of the diabetes or high blood pressure, you might prevent that protein from getting worse or having more and more of it in your urine.
Okay. All right. Because it did go down, but not as down as they wanted it.
Well, down is good.
Thank you,
Kathleen. Yeah, good.
Thank you, Kathleen. 800-348-2551. To Delmar, Catherine, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
About a year and a half ago, I went to the ER with intense abdominal pain, and they did an ultrasound, and they eventually decided that it was reflux. But they had noticed, incidentally, that I also had one of my kidneys was swollen, and so they referred me back to my general practitioner. And so I went, and they ordered a secondary ultrasound 6 months later, and they said that the swelling hadn't changed, and that I should probably follow up with the urologist. And I haven't done that, and I'm sort of wondering what could cause that swelling. I think it was in the outer part of the kidney. And do you think I should follow up?
Okay. So, you know, ultrasounds of the kidney, ultrasounds, if you've ever seen one, and many people have, right, when women are pregnant, they do ultrasounds to see where the baby's at and that kind of thing. And it kind of looks like bad TV from the 70s, very kind of patchy black and white stuff. So not the very best test that we have, but very good sometimes for kidney issues. And so not knowing exactly what your ultrasound looks like, I'll give you a couple of ideas of things that they may have seen. And so in some instances, you can see a little bit of swelling of the kidney if there's a blockage for some reason. And so in men, many times that's the prostate gland. And the prostate can block the flow of urine from the bladder and puts back pressure. And those tubes that deliver the urine from the kidney to the bladder can sometimes expand from the pressure. Can you imagine, just like if you put your fingers on the garden hose and it wants to expand? And so sometimes if there's a kidney stone or if there's some type of anatomic obstruction there, it can cause that kidney to swell. It can sometimes be swollen for infectious reasons. There are a couple of things like that are out there. Hard to know without really knowing you as a patient. But I do think it's a good idea to follow up, for sure.
And is a urologist the person that I would go to, or would I see someone more like you, like a nephrologist?
I think you could start in either place. I think that if you have an appointment with a urologist, that's absolutely fine.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. 800-348-2551. Keep going now. We have Brian in Buckland. Go ahead, Brian.
Hello, doctor. Thank you so much for the topic you're raising and your expertise. I want to bring you back to the original question that was asked, and that's more along the lines of prevention, or at least limiting the chance of moving into problems with kidneys. Hmm. And so the question I pose is, it seems that it's pandemic. The people are having to deal with high anxiety and stress and distress, and consequently, oftentimes, inappropriately self-soothing that with food, alcohol, drugs, and all other kinds of activities, all causing inflammation. I was wondering if you thought it was a good idea if, along with the physical, that we add the psychological and encourage people to be consciously grateful throughout their day and to be consciously compassionate to all beings they meet with appropriate boundaries to stimulate anti-inflammatory production versus inflammatory production.
Well, I see where you're going with that, and I think that it's an excellent thought. You know, there's a trend towards people looking at mindfulness and that practice of really being in the moment. And what we do know is that exercises like that kind of practice, like meditation and yoga, have been shown to decrease blood pressure. And so you can see definitely physical effects from what is generally kind of mental awareness. Now, if you have mental issues that require counseling and medication, it's also important, and those kind of things definitely get overlooked as well.
Type 1 and type 2 diabetes. I always get these mixed up. Type 1 is you're born with it, or is that type 2?
You're not generally born with it, although some children have that issue very early in life. But you can think of these two issues, type 1 diabetes or type 2 diabetes, being two different types of people. Type 1, the pancreas is just not making insulin. It just doesn't work. And so there is no insulin in the body. And so those patients need insulin. Type 2 diabetics are much, much more common. And in those patients, they're typically obese. And because of that, they have this metabolic syndrome where even though they have normal amounts, sometimes even more than normal amounts of insulin in their blood, they're resistant to it. So it doesn't do its job nearly as well. And so they tend to have the same effects of high blood sugars, but for different reasons.
We talked about transplants. We talked about dialysis. And I think those are probably the last resorts, I would imagine. What about medicine? Can you take a pill and heal your kidney?
Well, you can take medicine to help prevent kidneys from getting worse, even if they've been damaged already. Mm-hmm. What medicines don't do in general, if you have chronic kidney damage, is make that damage better. If you can imagine just having a bad cut on your skin, the body knows to heal itself by making a scar there. And although your skin healed up, that skin will never look exactly the same again. That scar is different from the other tissue there. The same thing is happening with the kidneys over time. If you have high blood pressure, you have diabetes, you start to get scarring in the kidneys over time, making more and more scars. Those scars don't ever get better, but what we hope to do is prevent that process from being ongoing so that you stop making those scars.
800-348-2551. Jerry is in Albany. Jerry, go ahead. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yes, hello. Okay,
hi.
So I have a history of kidney disease going back about 13 years when my primary care doctor, I go to the VA in Albany, primary care doctor noticed a slight increase in the creatinine level and started to monitor it every few months. And as time went on, it kept creeping up a few tenths of a point. And to make a long story short, all these years later, I'm all the way up to a 6.9 creatinine level. And I don't have any need for dialysis. I don't have all of the usual symptoms that people with advanced kidney disease have, such as swollen ankles and jaundice and you know, nausea and no appetite. I have a good appetite. I don't, my blood pressure is good. I'm, you know, except for some itching issues, which I understand is, you know, a symptom. I'm all the way up there at that creatinine level, and it's kind of a mystery, I guess. Would you consider that I'm an anomaly to have that type of condition with no symptoms?
Well, I wouldn't call you an anomaly. So just to give you an idea, and maybe a lot of patients or a lot of people who are listening to us don't know what creatinine is. And so there is a blood test that doctors can check. And I had mentioned earlier, that's a kind of screening test for kidney problems that's called creatinine. And even though that's generally recognized as our best marker for kidney function, it's a substance that doesn't come from the kidneys at all. And so people are often surprised to hear that. What's universal about it is that it comes from muscle. And so everyone has muscles, and so everyone has creatinine in their blood, and it's generally, it's a waste product that's coming from the muscles, very small like a salt, leaves the muscles and circulates in the blood until it gets to kidneys, and kidneys flush it out. So indirectly, if that creatinine level is rising, it tells us, hey, kidneys are not doing their job. And so the higher that creatinine is, the worse the kidney function is. Normal numbers around 1. So the higher you go, the worse it is. If you're in the 6 to 7 range, like you suggested, well, this almost always represents bad kidney function. Now, one person who is very, very muscular might make a lot more creatinine than another person who may be tiny without much muscle. So without knowing you as a patient, it would be hard for me to say exactly what your kidney function is. Now, it's also true that some patients can have very bad kidney function, and they're hanging in there. And so they don't feel that severe fatigue, that nausea, the weight loss. Those are the things that we really start to see. Now, just because you haven't experienced those things yet, not knowing, again, what your kidney function is, if it's very close to the point where doctors think you may need dialysis, one of the things that you should be thinking about is, well, what if things change and I did start to feel symptomatic? Do I have a good plan?
Do I have a good what?
Do I have a good plan? Would I be ready to choose a type of dialysis? Do I know anything about dialysis? I would suggest, you know, in any situation like that, that you spend time with a kidney doctor and get educated about what your options are.
Yeah, well, I have been seeing a nephrologist for most of the last 10 years. I've actually been... I've seen 4 different nephrologists over time in the VA system. They all have the same diagnosis, and they all claim that it's based strictly on the creatinine level readings. They have nothing else to go on. I've had multiple ultrasounds. I've had all kinds of, you know, screenings and testings and everything else, urinalysis on a regular basis with the blood work. And, you know, they still say that I'm in stage 5 kidney failure. There's no evidence of type 2 diabetes. There's no evidence of amyloidosis.
Sure, sure. Mm-hmm. Now, without going into detail about your own medical history, what I think we should work with is the function, because I think that was your question. Worrying about, hey, if I'm in stage 5, do I need dialysis if I feel good? And the answer is no, unless there are other things present. Sometimes patients can have electrolyte dysfunction, even though they feel good, that forces our hand to start dialysis. And so, again, I would work closely with those individuals that you've been working with so that you're educated enough that you know what your options are, including transplantation.
800-348-2551, Vox Pop, Medical Monday, nephrology. More in a moment. Medical Monday, Vox Pop. Michael, go ahead in Monroe.
Hi, Monroe, not Moron, Monroe.
Okay.
Yes, about 3.5 years ago, I had weight loss surgery, and one of the pre-op tests was an ultrasound of my gallbladder, and they found cysts in the kidney as a side note to that. So I went in for a follow-up. They found multiple cysts in both kidneys. I went back about 6 months later for a follow-up. They hadn't progressed. They told me I really didn't have anything to worry about. But is this something that I should be following up on periodically and have additional ultrasounds or any other diagnosis? I don't have any symptoms. My creatinine level is normal. So I just want to know if there's anything I should be doing now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michael, thanks for the question. And although I can't give you specific medical advice, I'll give you an idea of some of the things that we talk about when we see cysts. So in general, there are kind of two types of cysts. One is what we call a simple cyst, which is, if you can imagine, like a bubble in the tissue. Thin walls, like a bubble would have. And if you see one or two of those in a kidney, that generally doesn't lead us to a diagnosis of any disease. If we went to the mall together and found 10 people, maybe one or two would have a cyst, and it doesn't mean that they have disease. There's also a type of cyst called a complex cyst, which is really anything other than what is simple. So something that has thicker walls or septated in the middle, that kind of thing. Those types of cysts can sometimes turn into something else, maybe like a cancer. And so those definitely need follow-up. Now, when we talk about multiple cysts in each kidney, in both kidneys, it does get a little bit more concerning that there could be a disease related to the kidney that is a kind of cystic disease. Many times those cystic diseases run in families, and so it's usually not surprising when a person has one of those diseases because they'll say, oh, you know, my father was on dialysis and his mother was on dialysis, that kind of thing. So it is important to follow up when you have multiple cysts like that, again, not knowing your case history specifically.
Okay, thank you very much.
Of course.
Thank you very much. It's 800. It's 348-2551. This is Medical Monday, Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. Chris in Albany. Chris, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I have a question about my GFR rate. It was below normal one time, and then the next time it was tested, it was above normal, but they didn't give me an actual number. Mm. So I was just wondering if there's any significance to that.
Sure. And this is something that usually pops up on blood tests. And so
Right. One
of the things to remember about GFR, and what is GFR? GFR stands for the glomerular filtration rate, which is another way of talking about how good the kidney's filtering is. So I mentioned on another caller that when the creatinine is rising, it suggests that kidney function is getting worse. And so you can imagine, as creatinine is rising, GFR is falling. And GFR is actually not measured by the lab. It's calculated. So if for some reason your creatinine is higher, maybe you were under the weather, maybe you were behind in fluids, you were a little dehydrated, if they measured a higher creatinine, that might have caused that GFR to fall below the lab's threshold for normal. And then when you had it repeated, that creatinine was probably a little bit lower, and then the GFR went up. Okay. So you can see what's actually measured is creatinine, and the GFR
right.
is kind of a follow-up calculation based on that test.
I see. Yeah, I don't have the lab tests in front of me, but as I recall, the creatinine was within normal limits. And I don't think it had changed very much, but the BUN had gone up, although it was still in normal limits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and remember, what the lab considers normal is not necessarily what doctors consider normal. Labs are supposed to help you with diagnoses and things like that. And remembering that creatinine is involved in a math formula to give you the GFR, even if it's mm-hmm. within the normal range, up or down is going to change that GFR number.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. This is Vox Pop on WAMC. Let's talk to Jean in Wilton. Jean, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I was diagnosed with length-dependent small fiber polyneuropathy about 8 years ago. And I've always been concerned about diabetes because the endocrinologist who I saw later told me that her patients that had small fiber neuropathy often would have diabetes 10 years after their small fiber neuropathy diagnosis. But remember, it's length dependent. I always test normal when I have a fasting blood sugar. It comes out around 80. However, I looked back at my A1Cs, and they've been kind of going back and forth between 5.7, 5.5, 6.0, and the last one I had done was 6.0. And I know that's considered pre-diabetes. And I had one thing happen recently. Actually, it happened four times where I woke up in the middle of the night, had to urinate a lot, and when I woke up in the morning, I was dizzy. So I'm wondering if it's time I should see an endocrinologist about it. My family person said, or doctor said, not to worry about it, that since the 80 was okay, the 6.0 didn't mean that much.
So I think the question that you have is, does this require a trip to an endocrinologist, or is this more of a question of what can I do to lower my risk of fully becoming diabetic in the future?
Well, yes, it's partly should I see an endocrinologist, but I'm at a loss as to what to do about lowering the problem because I'm not overweight. I eat a really healthy diet, and I walk every day and go to the gym four times a week. So all the advice they give you on controlling your, you know, not getting diabetes, I'm already following. And I do have a family history of diabetes. So that's what has me kind of worried.
Yeah, so I can understand that. And Gene, I'll tell you, you're probably going to get that exact same advice wherever you go. You're doing everything right. If you maintain a healthy weight, you're exercising, you're eating a healthy diet, those are the best things that you can do to prevent that onset of type 2 diabetes.
So is the 6.0 A1C a concern, or should I not worry about it?
Well, if your doctors have suggested that there's a high incidence of diabetes in people who have the disorder that you have, then I would certainly continue to follow it. But it does not mean that you have diabetes.
Right. Okay. Now. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for calling, Gene. 800-348-2551. Let's talk to Cheryl in Milford, Pennsylvania. Cheryl?
Hi. Thank you, doctor, for answering this question. I'm calling for my 88-year-old mother, who up until 86 was driving and going to work. So she's normally been fairly healthy, but she does have congestive heart failure. And when she was 86, she wound up in the hospital for a completely unrelated issue. But then her kidney numbers started looking wonky to people. So they were playing around with the diuretics that she normally had. Now she's in assisted living, and about twice a year, same thing happens where the doctor will see through her blood work that her kidney numbers don't look well. But as soon as they start changing the medications and switching things around, she gets swelling in her legs. Recently, it was also in her hands. And I was wondering, is part of the issue here that they're trying to control this because of her congestive heart failure? She may not be a candidate for dialysis down the line, or is this fairly common practice? It's just that sometimes these side effects seem to be more scary than whatever she's dealing with before then.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for the call. And 88 years old, God bless her. What I would tell you is that that there's often a balance that doctors are trying to achieve. And really, the goals that we have are trying to be kind to patients, to decrease suffering, and to minimize hurting someone. And so in someone who may be a little bit fragile, maybe because of their age or medical conditions, especially with congestive heart failure and kidney disease at the same time, and not knowing her case specifically, in many instances, we'll give patients diuretics, which are water pills, and most people have heard of that, pills mm-hmm. that help you make a lot more urine so that you can get rid of swelling or get rid of some of that shortness of breath that you have. Now, unfortunately, in some people, taking those diuretics can make the kidney function worse. And so sometimes it's a little bit of a seesaw going back and forth between too much diuretics that make the kidney function worse and not enough diuretics, and the person is swollen and maybe a little bit short of breath. When that window gets smaller and smaller and smaller, sometimes dialysis is the answer because we can we can maintain a steady body weight that way and be able to remove fluid and not so much worry about where kidney function is at. But that's really a case-by-case kind of decision.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, too, because she's really only seeing her cardiologist. Would it help to see a nephrologist?
I would say if there's a discussion ongoing about maybe doing dialysis, then for sure she should be seeing a nephrologist or kidney specialist.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
Of course.
And Vicki. Vicki has been holding on for a long time now. Go ahead, Vicki in Ghent.
Hi. I'm a teacher and of high school kids, and for years, kids had to be very careful about their diets when they were diabetic. And they would, you know, prick their fingers and all that old-fashioned stuff. And now kids are all on pumps for insulin. And I noticed that they are not cognizant or about what they eat. They eat anything. And I'm just wondering if those pumps so effective that this symptoms of diabetes, like you were talking about with the blood vessels and blindness, do they not have those anymore because the pumps are so efficient and the kids can eat anything?
Well, thanks, Vicki. And really all comes down to control of the diabetes. Now, kids generally have type 1 diabetes, although we do have an epidemic of obesity in our children as well. And so some of them are coming down with type 2 diabetes. In general, I would not say that it's true that they can eat anything, although with insulin pumps and some of the new things that our endocrine colleagues have available to them, it becomes much more efficient to control blood sugars.
So I don't have to say, you know, you're crazy. You're going to be blind in 20 years because you're, you know, eating all those gummy bears.
Right. So something tells me that their endocrine doctor would not want them eating gummy bears. But, but you know, it really, type 1 diabetics have kidney disease more commonly than type 2. It's just a matter of the overwhelming numbers of type 2 diabetics compared to type 1s out there.
Yeah. Okay. So should my advice be to keep following that special diet, you know, or...
Everybody's a little bit different, and some people's blood sugars are a little bit more labile than others. And certainly, if a child is on an insulin pump, they should have both dietary advice and an endocrinologist that's helping to manage the pumps and the diet at the same time, because those are things that you want to have aligned so that you can have good control.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Vincent Carcillo, for joining us today. Support for WAMC and for Vox Pop comes from DentaQuest, whose mission is to increase access, affordability, and awareness, and to improve the oral health of all. Welcome to Preventistry. More at preventistry.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Medical Monday Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered today by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Brian Shields. Stay tuned now for The Media Project.